Hello, everybody. Before we dive into today's episode, we are brought to you by Routine. When we sleep, we lose between a pound and a half of water, mostly from expelling vapors and sweating. Routine came up with a product called Morning Routine. It's a single serve packet that contains half an organic lemon, 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, Himalayan sea salt, all 6 essential electrolytes, and no sugar. I just tear one of these open, dump it into my water first thing in the morning, and honestly, I feel so much more hydrated when I use it. Highly recommend you trying Morning Routine to just give you a hydration boost to your day first thing in the morning before you grab your cup of coffee. If you want to try Morning Routine, go to yourroutine.com and use code ShaneWhite30 at checkout. You'll receive 30% off your first order. Today, we're also brought to you by Elite Sweets. Elite Sweets is redefining the way we think about sweets with their Elite Donut. The Elite Donut is a better-for-you donut that is packed with 13 grams of protein, gluten-free, keto-friendly, and most importantly, in my opinion, contains only 1 gram of sugar. So if you want a sweet, but you don't want to ruin your macros, don't want to ruin your diet, grab yourself an Elite Donut. Again, there's 13 grams of protein, so they're a great protein snack. I love these things, especially when I'm just craving something sweet. It's something that I would probably ruin my diet on, but I grab an Elite Donut instead, get 13 grams of protein. They also have a new flavor, maple, they just launched, and they're also shelf stable now. So check. They're easy to store in your pantry, take them with you on the go. They're fantastic. I love them. You can get yours today at EliteDonut.com or on Amazon. Either way, if you use code ShaneWhite30, you'll get 30% off your order. We're also brought to you by NeuroRoast today. Today's episode is brought to you by NeuroRoast, a company that's dedicated to helping you optimize your brain function and overall well-being. NeuroRoast's flagship product is their premium mushroom coffee, which is made with an organic single-origin coffee and their signature blend of 5 different functional mushrooms: cordyceps, lion's mane, reishi, turkey tail, and chaga. Mushroom coffee is a new and exciting way to supercharge your day. Unlike regular coffee, which can cause jitters and crashes, mushroom coffee provides a more balanced and sustained energy boost, allowing you to stay focused and productive throughout the day. And with NeuroRoast ground and instant coffee options, you can enjoy the benefits of mushroom coffee wherever and whenever you need it. And here's some great news for my listeners today. NeuroRoast is offering an exclusive discount code just for you. If you use code ShaneWhite, and that's just Shane White, one word, during checkout at NeuroRoast.com, you'll get 30% off your order of NeuroRoast mushroom coffee. So whether you choose the ground or instant option, the Shane White 30 discount code will work for 30% off. All right, everybody. Without further ado, the episode is up right after this. Everybody, welcome to another episode of the Shane White Show. I'm pumped to have Lauren Chu on the podcast. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I told you before we got on here, but I always like to preface it because I give you a lot of credit. I moved this podcast a bunch of times, so thank you for your flexibility. Appreciate it. I know you're hustling and trying to grow a brand, so
no worries. I have a kid too, so it's all good.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. I know it's been such a fun 4 months, but it's such a change to just.
Oh my God. Your kid is 4 months.
Yeah. He turned 4 months yesterday.
Oh my God. You're in the thick of it.
Shout out to my wife. She's an all-star. She makes my life easier, but it's just wild how much that throws your day into chaos some days. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know. For everyone listening, Lauren, would you mind giving everyone just a quick background on who you are and what your brand is?
Yeah, definitely. So my name's Lauren. I'm the founder of Love and Chew. We bake delicious protein cookies, primarily targeted towards women, but they really are for everyone. We use mostly California sourced ingredients. And really my goal was to create a delicious cookie that hit all the nutritionals that I wanted, but also tasted great. And so our products are primarily sweetened by California sourced dates. Mm. And then we kind of hit all the nutritionals that consumers are looking for, like vegan, gluten-free, no refined sugar, paleo, et cetera. So
love it.
You can find us nationally in Sprouts. We are in the process of doing a bunch of different rotations through Costco, so depending on your region.
Congratulations.
And then we are expanding through Whole Foods Market this summer, which is really exciting.
You're hitting what I would call the big three. That's amazing. Yeah,
you know, honestly, they're my dream accounts. And I just feel so much gratitude for the journey. It's like, sometimes I wake up and I'm just like, I can't believe this is my life.
Yeah, no, I bet. I mean, that's, you know, obviously where you are today. To back way up, I would love to know. So what year did you start the company?
Yeah, so it's going to be 5 years next month. So it's
not that long. It feels like it, I'm sure. But in the grand scheme of where you're at, that's actually pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, so we raised a friends and family round. I did kind of the typical thing. Like, I maxed out my credit cards. I put my life savings into the business. Again, when people ask me like what to do up front, it depends on your financial situation. It depends what else you have going on in your life. But we've grown very slowly and thoughtfully. I think it's really easy to get into this like comparison game. Like, for example, I'm sure everyone saw the headlines like Olipop, they're 5 years mm-hmm. old. They hit $200 million in sales. We're nowhere near that. And that's okay, right? Like, everyone's on their own journey in this industry. It's also a very, very costly industry, especially in retail. So we, from day one, we were focused on profitability and just growing the business consciously and working with the customers that we feel not only are good partners on both sides, but also are a fit for our brands, and we can really grow and expand together. So that's just been my thought process.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. I always find it very interesting when founders go down the route that you went to. So when you first started this, was it the typical story also where were you like baking these in your own kitchen and just kind of come up with your own recipe? And is that how you kind of started it from that standpoint?
So I adapted one of my stepmom's vegan cookie recipes.
Okay.
And we both went vegan. Well, she was vegan earlier than I was, but we were vegan at the time. I still consider myself to be plant-based. And I mean, I could go on about it. I eat plant-based because of environmental reasons primarily. And then I'm okay. a lover of animals. I also think it's one of the healthiest diets. But at the same time, when building this brand, I'm not saying to everyone, hey, you should go vegan. It's not sustainable for a lot of people. So, but I think you can go vegan-ish and, you know, go vegan a couple of days a week and be more flexitarian about it. So
I've never heard that term, flexitarian. Okay.
Yeah. Like
that would be quite a transition for me. I'm like on the other end of the spectrum, I think. I would love to learn though, a whole nother conversation, but I would love to learn more about it. It's like an area I don't know enough about.
I mean, there's so many products and so much education, and there's all these amazing cookbooks, and it's interesting. Like, I've thought about this a lot. Like, I've never been a big meat or seafood eater.
Okay.
But when you put those proteins like on a plate, those flavors really overpower the other things that you're eating on the plate. And then when you completely remove them, it actually lets other ingredients really shine, especially if, like, you know, you're buying locally sourced ingredients in season. There's a lot you can do with it. So.
Got it. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I hate seafood, so I'm like completely not a seafood. I always make the joke, I'm like, if I could eat something on land, I'll pick that every time, but whole nother story. So
well, you should never go to Japan because they eat seafood for breakfast, basically.
Oh, do they? I just saw you posted something about going over there. That's funny you say that.
I was
that.
Like, no, I'm good, but my husband was all over it. That's funny. Yeah.
That's funny. Okay, cool. So you had a recipe, you said from your stepmom?
Yes.
Very cool. So you had her recipe and you started doing it. There, like when I think about going zero to one, to me, that's always this right here is the pivotal like time frame, whether that's a week, a month, a year, whatever, to go from messing around in your own kitchen with a recipe you have to now selling it in, you know, Whole Foods, Costco, Sprouts. What was like the first, give everyone that's listening, because I think a lot of people that listen to this are in that stage of like, they have an idea, they're messing around with something, but to go from where you were at that time frame to where you are now feels like such an uphill battle. Like, how the hell is it even possible to do that? So what would you tell people like the first month, the first 3 months? Like, how did you kind of start selling it and testing it with people?
Yeah. So, I mean, I hadn't quit I was working in tech. So I hadn't quit my job at this point. And unless you are able to raise money and sell on this like idea before your product even exists, which was possible in the past, but I think is harder to do now.
Sure.
I don't recommend quitting your job. I was consulting, still working in tech, still working on the recipe. And then what we started doing is I had a home cottage operation. So I was delivering to like local grocery stores and baking cookies in my kitchen.
Oh, wow.
And then it wasn't until we got a large order from a food service opportunity. It was a couple of pallets where I was like, oh crap, I need to go find a co-packer. And honestly, what you make at home in your kitchen tastes entirely different than what a co-packer makes.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. It's more of an automated situation. There's commercial equipment. Like if you can imagine what a Hobart mixer is, it's basically a ginormous stand-up mixer. Mm-hmm. You're baking like, you know, 200-pound batches, right? Whereas in your kitchen, you're dealing in grams. So it's just a different scale. Product tastes different. So we had to tweak our recipe a bit to commercialize and scale. So that process actually took a while. It was like at least 6 months or so. I mean, we delivered product, but it was a process in terms of scaling and then optimizing as well, right?
Yeah. Were you generating sales already then? So by the time you did that, I'm assuming you already obviously were selling in certain, whether it was online or...
Yeah, we were generating sales. I mean, that's the other thing. I was demoing a ton.
Oh.
So I was kind of like, I knew what batch was what. And I was like trying to understand when you demo as a founder, you should never tell people that you're the founder, right?
Okay. Why do you say that?
Well, because to your face, like they'll be like, oh, the product tastes great. And you're not getting that like real time feedback that you're really looking for to tweak your product.
Oh, that's interesting. So if you would have just said like, oh no, I'm just helping the brand. I'm sampling it, like acting like you're not a part of it. Oh, that's really interesting.
I still do it. Like I'll demo. I don't tell anyone I'm the founder because I really want to know. I want people to be real with me.
Mm-hmm.
If they know it's my product, they're going to be like, oh, it tastes great. Like, yeah, awesome.
that makes a ton of sense. So were you selling online and then in some retailers around you? Or how did you, like, where was your first point of sale? And like, how did you start scaling sales early?
Our first customer was Rainbow Grocery in San Francisco.
Oh,
and then we were doing a lot of, you know, independents and coffee shops. We had no distribution. I was personally delivering the cookies. The coffee shops would pay me in cash. It was kind of funny.
Okay. So you like came up with a recipe that you felt like was good enough to sell. And then you just started hitting the streets and like trying to get this into places.
Exactly. Yeah.
Was your goal at that time? Like, did you have a goal in mind that you want to be this, you know, Costco brand at that point? Or were you just like trying to see if you can get it in small little places and it was a side hustle?
I wasn't even thinking about that, honestly.
Okay. Yeah.
It was almost just like a side hustle at the time, to be honest. I thought to myself, oh, it'd be cool to be in Whole Foods, but Costco was not on the horizon at that point in time.
Got it. Okay. And you guys didn't have a website or anything at this point?
We had a really basic website that did not work well.
Okay. Yeah. It was more like a landing page and not really to drive sales.
Yeah, exactly. We're not really an e-commerce native brand. Now we're more, we do a lot more e-commerce, but we can get into that later. I think that's like driven by retail, to be honest,
in a lot
of ways, and influencer marketing. So
definitely all that stuff works really well together.
Yeah.
So you get into a few, so are you based in SF? Is that where you're at now?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So you're getting into some, you know, specialty retailers, sounds like coffee shops. Was the reaction pretty good? Like right out the gate, were you getting people, you know, was the product moving? Were you getting reorders? How did it go the first few months of just being?
No, it was, I mean, it was honestly depending on where it was. So we did well in coffee shops, right? Because there's not a lot of SKUs in coffee shops, right? Mm-hmm. But then we had a retailer that put us in the bakery section, and that wasn't a good place for us to be. And we kind of learned that as we spent more time in retail, that like for a functional cookie like us, we actually should be in like nutrition bars.
Oh, so. Got it. It's more like a competitor to Lenny and Larry's type of play. Sort of thing.
That came later though. But like it also, our packaging was terrible. Like nobody noticed us.
Okay. Oh, I never thought about that. Yeah. So packaging matters, where it's sitting matters. Yeah. Cause I'm sure some folks didn't really understand what the difference was. And I'm assuming it was a lot more expensive than the products you were sitting next to in the bakery.
Yeah, we were probably in the $4 price range at that point. I was buying ingredients from Costco.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I mean, our packaging was hard to read, not very noticeable. I was trying to cut costs. So like we had caddies for our cookies and we had like, we only had two SKUs at that time too. And so the caddies were the same color, but it was like a light color that was not noticeable again. That's why like, I would say like a lot of founders, I think they want that like beautiful packaging right away. And it's like, if you have the money to pay the fancy design agency and have this beautiful branding, fine. But I honestly like think throw it into retail, see how it looks amongst everything else, and then just spend all your time demoing to kind of just understand where your product fits in the set, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. It's like getting a minimal viable product.
Yeah, exactly.
You're probably one of the first people I've talked to, though, that has said to try to get it tested in retail. I think it's a really interesting strategy. And I would assume most people, maybe myself included, would have assumed that like getting the first couple green lights in retail would actually be really, really hard without any other sales history. So were you using like the coffee shops and the specialty locations as like a kind of like a proving ground, and then you were going to retail, or was retail just willing to take a chance on a local brand?
Yeah, I mean, when I talk about retail in this context, it's local retail. So like you're walking into the store and dropping off samples and talking to the buyer, not like a Whole Foods market or whatever. Sure. And it depends where you live, right? Like San Francisco is a community that really champions local brands. Another good place to go is like the farmers market and set up a stand there.
Yeah.
To build the brand. So I just think that San Francisco in general is just they're open to new brands. It doesn't work for every single market.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So
were you able to build a pretty solid following, a pretty decent circle of sales in the SF area? Like what was that? How long did it take you to kind of get a footprint of sales in San Francisco before you expanded further?
Yeah. So this is when the story kind of turns a little bit. So I think we were in like 50-ish stores and I was self-delivering and I was like looking at our sales. And then I was like looking at the time spent like delivering. And I mean, I was like driving up to my co-packer. They're an hour away. We still work with them, and like picking up the cookies, putting it in my car, using my apartment as storage, that whole thing. And I was just like, how do I scale this thing? And like, how does it become profitable? And then my friend who was working at LinkedIn at the time, he brought some of my cookies to his cafeteria manager. And so when they picked us up and then they put in that two pallet order, this is kind of when we transitioned to a larger co-packer.
So you went from putting boxes in your car to getting a two pallet order. That's a pretty big jump.
Yeah. And because the tech companies, and I know they're kind of cutting back on it now, but at the time, it's kind of free for all, like snacks for employees. And they have a lot of employees. So I was like, okay, this is interesting. I need to focus on this channel.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of scale. There's one point of delivery. It's very profitable. So that's kind of where we transitioned to after that.
Okay. So and they're still in California, I'm assuming, is LinkedIn. And
yeah. A lot of our food service customers are still in California.
Nice.
So, but it's actually national, like Meta has offices in Austin, Texas, and we do some offices in New York City too. So
you kind of went you went down just a rabbit hole of getting into basically all, I'm assuming all of the office spaces you could, because you knew that was an area.
Yeah. But then it came to like a screeching halt because COVID hit.
Yeah. I was doing that timeline in my head. I'm like, you're running right into COVID, aren't you?
Yes. Running right into COVID. I probably made a mental decision like the year before. Okay. I'm going to just go after these wholesale accounts, these food service accounts. And then COVID hits and it's literally like, we all think we're going to die, right? I don't know if you felt that way.
Everything
just comes to a screeching halt. I have like maybe 20 pallets of product stranded, like all over the place. There's some great short sale folks out there, like Misfits Market, Imperfect Produce. They bought the product. So that worked out fine. But then during COVID, I was like, do I shut down the business? Or do I pursue another channel? What do I do? So that's when we started getting more serious about e-commerce. But then also serious about scaling retail, basically.
Got it. Okay.
So like, where are the customers during COVID? They're at home or, you know, they're ordering groceries, right?
Right. Yeah, 100%. So when you came to that conclusion, what was the thought process just in general about closing the business? Like, were you pretty close to actually potentially going down that rabbit hole?
Yeah. I mean, I was just like, this is hot. Like, this is hard. Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, we had all these sales that were very consistent through this channel. We were set up in the national distributor for food service. We still are. And it literally just went to zero. Like, I'd never seen anything like that before.
Sure. So. And at the time, did you have e-commerce really set up, or were you in a position where you had to kind of fire it up when you were in?
No, we had to do like a whole, like, we moved, we were like on Wix. We had to move over to Shopify. We had to do a whole thing.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's tough, right? You're like not generating revenue. Did you still have the full-time job at this point?
No, I had quit my job, and was on this full-time. So,
oh, okay. So even better. So now all your eggs are in this basket, right? So
yeah.
Oh, that's a bummer. Yeah. Got it. Okay. Yeah.
But it honestly was a great, it was a great growth. I'm sure for you and many others, like, it was a great growing moment, and it's really impacted me about like how I think about the future of the business, to be honest.
Yeah.
And
like resiliency, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And I will never be so reliant on one channel ever again.
Yeah. It's funny, right? Like, you'd hope in our lifetime that something like that wouldn't happen again. But yeah, I think anyone who went through it now is like, well, don't bank on one thing. I know for me, it was like a time to look at my time during the day, like how much I'm spending on different things, and all the time back I was commuting back and forth into the city here in Chicago, and I just, you know, yeah, basically I got two and a half hours back of my day every single day. So I'm with you. That's crazy.
Yeah. You would spend 2.5 hours a day commuting.
And I'm not that far outside the city, but like, I had a, you know, time I left my house and I had a bike to the train, and then usually, you know, wait for the train for a few minutes, get on the train. Yeah, it was another probably 30 to 35 minute train ride. And then I had a 15 minute walk from the train station to the RX Bar office. So it was like usually an hour from door to door all in. Wow. And then, you know, it just seemed like there was always things in the middle that slowed it down. So yeah, I always said like 2 to 2.5 hours, probably depending on what train, but either way, yeah, it's what started this. I started using that time to start a podcast. It was funny because if you can't tell, I enjoy talking to people, and being a finance guy who likes talking to people is pretty rare. And I was like, I can't just like sit in my house and keep working without, I wanted to meet more people and use the time that I got back to kind of grow my network. So that's why the podcast started. But
that's awesome. Yeah, funny. I love that. Yeah. Like, you're kind of taking lemons and turning it into lemonade.
Yeah, I like to think so. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I feel like a lot of people look back on that time and either they did something productive, or they kind of just, you know, binge watched more, drank more, did something with their time that maybe wasn't super productive. But yeah. Yeah,
I did the drinking and binge watching for 2 weeks, and I was like, this is not working.
This can't be my life for the next year. Yeah, exactly. Well, that's really interesting. So you fire up e-commerce as quick as you can. Were you on, you said you went to Shopify, so obviously your own D2C site. Did you also do like Amazon and other platforms to try to just like,
yeah, we used that time to get on Amazon. I hired like I took a course through Amazon. We also hired an agency as well. Now we actually manage Amazon in-house. So. Okay.
Got it. Good for you guys. Yeah. I mean, it was such a wild time for brands that wanted to get on, that were not online, to get online. And, you know, looking back, it's just some of like the craziest time in history as far as like search volume on some of those platforms.
I know. And, you know, now there's all this like press about how e-commerce is over or whatever for brands.
Yeah.
And everyone's like omni-channel. It's just really funny. I feel like it just depends on what's going on in the year. There's just, you need to do this. Okay. Now sure. You need to do this.
Yeah. Right. And I, you know, it's funny. I work with a variety of brands, and it's also, depends on what you're selling, right? And your brand awareness. It is tough if you're a brand that has no brand awareness and you're relying on Amazon, for example, to just like build your brand.
I think it's harder to do that now for sure.
Yeah. There's a lot of competition. So, you know, what was easy to win bids a couple of years ago is just a lot tougher today, but definitely, you know, the brands that have some retail and then go on Amazon, at least you have a lot of people looking for you online.
Yeah. I mean, that's like basically what happened to us. Like when we launched Sprouts National, we saw our Amazon sales like 2x in a month. Oh, yeah. Like it was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And at RxBar, like, we always said that.
We just have a branded terms ads going. Like we're not spending more. Like no celebrity shouted us out. So,
okay. You know? Yeah. No, it's funny. Like I know just from even my time at RxBar, every time we got a major retail distribution unlock, shortly after that, there was usually a pretty specific step change in our Amazon sales. And I think it's just inevitable that so more and more households are Prime members now. And so you try something once in the store and then you're on Amazon next time and you're like, wait, it's the brand I just tried for the first time. It's super convenient to just add it to my cart and get it here tomorrow. I think it's just an inevitable thing for brands. I always say it's, you know, depending on your situation and what you're selling, it's like, it's just good just to be there and be, have a good presence and not let someone else who's selling products out of a garage be, you know, the face of your brand on Amazon. Cause it's like, whether you want to be on it or not, you're going to be on it is always my mentality.
Yeah. No, it's true. Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of up to the brand.
With Costco, people went in and bought our pouches and sold them, resold them on Amazon. Which is hard to control.
Yeah, exactly. A price pack architecture is important. And it's tough, especially when you have the Costcos of the world knocking on your door.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. And they want it. And you're like, well, these volumes are enormous. I'm going to take that.
Yeah.
So really cool. So you fire up e-com, you decide to stay in business. What did the next, you know, 6 to 12 months look like after you made the decision to keep your foot down on the pedal and keep going?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing that happened to us during this time period, and I do want to say, like, retail takes time. So I probably was talking to them like a year and a half, 2 years prior to, but we were brought into Whole Foods, just one region, Northern California, our home territory. So we did launch that, not during COVID, but kind of towards when COVID, people were getting more chill about COVID, basically. So that was huge for us. Because like the thing about Whole Foods is you get access to the sales data.
Sure,
It's like a week lag, but I mean, that's really unique. Most retailers don't give that to you. So we could try out different marketing campaigns and see like how that impacted sales, whether we went on sale, whether we demoed, whether we sent influencers into stores. So that was a great, and it was only 45 stores in the region. So that was just like a really great ground to like just test different marketing strategies.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, Whole Foods seems like it'd be such a perfect retailer for you guys with what you're selling. So were the velocities healthy enough that you were able to expand pretty quickly?
Yeah. I mean, Whole Foods is like one of our best retailers.
Sure. Oh, yeah, I bet.
We also realized that being in the nutrition bar aisle is really our home in Whole Foods, just due to the velocities. And so, yeah, we are expanding this summer through Whole Foods. And so we're expanding maybe about half the country. So we're going to like Arizona, Colorado, Southern California, Texas. And again, that's a conscious decision on my part. Like, when I think about retail and expanding, it does cost money. So we're doing this very consciously.
Got it. Well, good for you guys, man. That's super exciting.
We're really excited about it.
What for you has been the biggest surprise of unlocking retail distribution, would you say? Especially the big ones.
It's been expensive. It's been more, I've been told, how the system is set up. And I still find myself surprised. Well, now I'm not surprised anymore. I know what to expect, but, cause we've been in the two largest, natural distributors for a while now. But it's been really expensive. And I think, you really need to figure that into your margins.
Yeah. That's a really good piece of feedback for everyone listening. I know I was always amazed with just like how confusing it is for brands. I mean, if anyone can figure that out, that's a business in itself. You could work with the two big guys and figure out a better way to get better visibility, because there's a whole team. There's usually a whole team at a big brand that's managing deductions and trade. And, you know,
we have a person that's dedicated to deductions right now. You have to be extremely detail oriented. You have to stay on top of it because you could potentially be leaving thousands and thousands of dollars on the table.
Yeah, like, it's crazy,
not exaggerating.
Right? Yeah, it's amazing how many like goof ups and errors there are too.
Yes.
That if you're not paying attention, you're just paying. It's crazy.
Yeah, and your relationship with the distributors is really important. it's always good to have a close relationship, like with your account manager, even the accounts payables folks. Because, you know, you can get lost there. They're big companies.
Yeah. No, for sure. They're huge.
Yeah.
So that's wild. So you're kind of going through that whole thing. Has the team grown during this time? Like, are you guys growing as an organization?
We've grown a lot. Still running pretty lean. We have like a full-time head of ops, also full-time head of sales. We have someone doing deductions, a marketing person, and then like a junior ops person. So
awesome. For people who are at the stage where they think they need to start hiring, what, out of all of those, I'm sure all of them are very, very important roles. What was like the first one? Or if you did it over again, what would you say, what would have been the most important to hire first?
Yeah. So as the founder, or if you're a couple of, or a few founders, you need to just like, honestly, look at your own skill sets and what you're strong at, and then hire around you. So for me, I have like a sales and business development background. So we waited a little bit longer to hire a full-time salesperson. And what really brought us the value was hiring a full-time ops person.
That makes sense. Yeah. Ops is one of those functions where if they're good at ops too, it could just be the differentiator, I think, and whether it's staying in stock or just handling all sorts of issues that if you're not good at it, can take up a lot of time and resources.
Yeah. I mean, we were, prior to our ops person starting, she started 2 years ago, we were constantly out of stock.
Yeah, and I'm sure.
This should have been very obvious to me at the time, but it's kind of wasn't. Our sales doubled by hiring that ops person because she just kept us in stock.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
we see that sometimes even on Amazon, just like trying to help brands think forward. And it's amazing sometimes just like, you don't realize the ceiling you have in certain avenues when you just, the Achilles heel of so many brands is being out of stock.
Oh, 100%. We've been, there is kind of like a, right, because you don't want to have so much capital tied up in inventory and like, you don't want to code out in Amazon. So there is sort of that sweet spot. But like, yeah, we always joke internally about Amazon, like keep feeding the machine.
Yeah, right. Especially that flywheel. You don't want that flywheel to stop.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's true. I think it's honestly the hardest for food and beverage brands because you obviously have a shelf life. I'm sure brands that are in food and beverage are always envious of, you know, whether it's shelf stable or it's just like a home goods product that has no shelf life. Totally.
Oh yeah, for sure. We have a relatively short shelf life for a product that goes through distribution. We're at 7 months.
Oh, okay.
So we actually have to watch closely what we ship into the distributors, because we've had issues in the past where we'll code out and, you know, they'll charge you back and it's costly.
Right. Yeah. It's like lose-lose for everybody, right?
Yeah.
That's a really good call. What was it like getting the green light acceptance for your first Costco region? I would love to just hear what your reaction was, because that, I think for so many brands, that's such a huge moment.
I mean, it was, our Costco story is not a normal one. Like, I have friends that have been trying to get into Costco or finally got into Costco after 10 years. And that was just not our story. Like, we, and I just want to preface, like, usually it does take a long time, and it took us a long time to get into Sprouts. I think it took us 3 years to get into Sprouts. So it just, everyone has a different journey. Maybe you just get lucky with the buyer loves your product, or you just hit what they're looking to purchase at that time. Like, it's just really hard to know.
Sure.
But yeah. I mean, from the first conversation to us actually launching was about 10 months. And we developed a new SKU for Costco, of course.
That's
like insane, especially for a company our size and the fact that we were able to pull it off operationally.
Did you, volumes,
creating a new SKU. My reaction was like shock.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. Did they approach you, or did you get a hold of them, or how did that process?
So we actually, we got connected with a Costco broker.
Okay.
And then he was able to, we just hit a lot of things that he was looking for. And he was ready to, like, a lot of people are told, like, let's do 5 or 6 locations, let's do a roadshow, or let's do 20 locations. Like, he was ready to go big. So okay.
Sometimes it's like just right place, right time, right?
I honestly think it was luck. I think our products are great, and, you know, it tastes good and everything, but I think we got lucky, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's part of it. I think some of everything you see success in business comes with a little bit of luck, right?
Yeah.
That's like famously Guy Raz, who has How I Built This. He always asks that question at the end, like how much of it was skill, how much of it was luck, do you think? So.
Yeah. And to be honest, there was like a huge string of failures prior to.
I'm sure. Yeah. What would you, I get, you know, we don't have a ton of time left. But I would love to understand that. Like what would you say so far in your journey? What has been like the biggest failure that you've had to overcome? Does one stand out to you?
Yeah. I mean, we've kind of had every different type of failure that, I don't know, on the retail side, to be honest, like we launched in a retailer that I think was, the timing was wrong because we didn't have the brand recognition. Like, I think even now we'd have a very different outcome. It was also the personality of the buyer that we were working with at the time. It really depends. Like some buyers, like they're willing to give you more time to prove yourself. Some are just very data driven. And if you don't hit those numbers, then you're gone.
Okay.
So, I mean, we did have a failure. We launched an 120 store chain. Product wasn't selling at the check stand.
Which is expensive.
Yeah, we paid to be in the check stand. Turns out half the check stands were closed, which didn't help us, obviously.
That sucks.
We weren't
hitting
obnoxious. Our numbers. We were coding out because of our short shelf life. And we were cut pretty swiftly. And that was a powerful lesson for us. I think we probably lost like 30 grand on that account. We're still getting charged back for it, for the shrinkage. So,
okay. Yeah.
It was an expensive lesson.
I forget the exact, I'm going to butcher the saying, but it's more important to move product off the shelf than to get product onto the shelf. I mean, it's such a true thing in CPG, right? Like if it's amazing when you get the unlock, like if you get the doors, amazing. But yeah, if you can't sell it, it's
the work
it's
starts
bigger,
when you
worse.
Get on the shelf. It was, I had a gut feeling. I'm not personally a shopper of this particular chain, but I'd spent time in it and I had a gut feeling it wasn't going to work. And I should have just followed that gut feeling, to be honest.
It's also funny, like there's inevitably going to be some better for you products that it's not great for every retailer. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Right. Cause if you crush it in the ones where it is the right consumer, you can still build a massive business and,
exactly.
And you don't have kind of like this slow moving long tail that's causing issues with deductions and taking inventory that's not necessarily moving fast enough. So that's a good learning lesson, especially for people who are trying to unlock distribution that are listening to this. That's awesome.
And you have to think about, like, that's why I think it's so important to talk to people in the industry, especially people that are like at the same stage as you or like one or two steps ahead. Because it's really good to understand like what type of customer they are.
Sure.
Like, if they don't pay on time, that really screws up your cash flow, for example.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it may not even be worth the cost of doing business with them, right? Because if you're using like a line of credit, for example, to fund your inventory, and then your customer is paying you 30 days later or whatever, you're paying those financing costs, right, during that extra time period, which hits your margins, and it may just not even be worth doing.
Yeah,
you know what I
right.
mean?
No, that's a great point. I know it's tough to break down in a podcast all of those moving pieces that hit you when you talk about deductions and cash flow.
Yeah.
I always say on here, and I feel like every founder that comes on here says something similar. It's such an important part of a young business as they're scaling, especially in food and bev CPG, to like have a good grip on that, right? And just like make sure you understand what you're signing up for, because to your point, I mean, it can be like the death of a lot of brands too, by just not understanding the investment they're getting into. And if it doesn't work, what happens on the back end? Hi, everybody. Unfortunately, we had a little technical difficulty right here where the episode just cut off. Lauren's audio and video, unfortunately, did not record all the way to the end. We had a few more minutes left, but really the end of this podcast, we kind of get into just where they are in retail and wanted to give Lauren a chance to share with all of you all of the great places you can get Love and Chew, the superfood cookie. Honestly, guys, after this episode, she sent me some. They are delicious. They've been in my fridge. Me and my wife actually put them in the fridge. You don't have to. And they've been really, really good. They have all different types of flavors. Banana bread, cherry, almond are the two that stand out to me right off the bat. And I know another big news for them, nationwide Sprouts launch just happened. They are available in some Costco regions. For all of you guys that wanted to try the product and really get to taste what Lauren created, you can go to loveandchew.com. That's their website, and check them out there. I'll add that link to the show notes so you don't have to find it. I will also add Lauren's LinkedIn so that you guys can go and reach out to her if you'd like to learn more about her brand or just get in touch with Lauren directly. So for all of you guys listening, thank you so much for listening to the show today. Sorry that the episode cut out there at the end, but I think it was still a fantastic episode with lots of good knowledge to be shared. Everybody, again, thank you for listening to the show. And if you want to try Love and Chew cookies, go to the show notes, click on the link, and give it a shot. And as always, thanks, everybody.